The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Hey, Crawl Space listeners. We wanted to bring you a special episode of one of our other podcasts called Empty Frames. And this episode kind of tugs at our heartstrings a little bit because the fellow, Charlie Hill, the art detective, he passed away back in a few weeks ago in February of 2021. And he was the last episode that we produced on Empty Frames and technically the last interview we've done. We only spoke to him in November, Lance.
Yeah, I spoke to him in November, and then around the holidays, we reached out just to say hello, check in on him. And then we hear that he died of a massive heart attack on February 20th. And it's really unfortunate. He was 73 years old. And I'm pretty certain when we spoke with him, we spoke for a while, but I'm pretty certain that all of his 73 years were filled with some form of adventure. Even the conversation we had with him had some adventure to it. If anybody is a fan of the painting, The Scream by Munch, he was the one that returned it after it was stolen in 1994. It was stolen from the National Museum in Oslo, and he was the one that found it. So if you're a fan of that painting, you have Charlie Hill to thank for it.
Yep. Charlie worked as an undercover detective in the Art Squad unit in Scotland Yard, which is pretty cool. And he also helped recover a stolen Vermeer, and there's only about 34 of those in the world, so they believe, and each one is a masterpiece. He also helped recover a stolen Titian and a Goya. Pretty remarkable. Very, very famous paintings.
That's correct. The Vermeer that he recovered was the lady writing a letter with her maid, and that's one of the more famous Vermeers. But our hearts rest easy knowing that Charlie lived a very full life. He affected a lot of people, had a really positive impact on the art community. And to his credit, through everything that he did, through all the criminals that he communicated with and all of those situations, he still remained a man of faith. And the email that he responded with after we reached out to see if he wanted to come on the show was tongue-in-cheek. It was witty. It was full of dry humor. And it was full of faith. And he was a really genuine, I'd say, about as genuine as they come. You know, he wore his heart on his sleeve, and he loved to impart his wisdom on people, and he loved to teach. That's just what I got out of that really, really unfortunately short relationship that we had with him.
That's right, Lance. I think we were both pretty affected by him, even our brief contact with him. I don't think we'd be doing this if we weren't. He just seemed like a funny, warm guy. He just kind of felt like we knew him already. I don't know. It's sad. It's sad that he's gone, and sad because he sounded like the most credible person we've ever had on our Empty Frames show as far as where the art might really be. I believed him, too. He had that luck factor, and he actually talked about being in the Army and how there was his fellow soldiers. They started a mutiny, and but they wanted him. They needed him to come with them or be their boss. That's how this guy inspired. And again, we only spent an hour with him, and we're talking about him, gushing over him, really, months later. So he left an impact.
Right. Super humble guy. And I think that's what led to the credibility that you just spoke of, that he seemed like one of the more legit people that we've had on Empty Frames when talking about where the paintings were and what leads had been followed up on. And it was extremely impressive how, again, humble he was and how patient he was with his investigation, you know, not only with the Gardner Museum heist, but his previous investigations, but especially with the Gardner heist. He had people who he was communicating with, establishing real relationships with, because he cared that much about it, and he cared that much about them, and he cared that much about the reputation of people who might not have anything to do with the heist. And he wanted to make that clear, that this was not about sullying anyone's reputation or gaining any international, you know, superstardom on his part for solving the case.
Right. Listen to his words. They were very deliberate. And his appearance on the show was very deliberate, Lance. Okay, everyone, I really hope you enjoy this interview with Charlie Hill. We're going to play the entire episode, and make sure to subscribe to Empty Frames. And thanks a lot. And follow us at Crawl Space Pod on Twitter. On March 18, 1990, the most audacious art heist of all time took place at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. Two men dressed as police officers were admitted into the building by security, claiming to be responding to a disturbance call.
In 81 minutes, 13 pieces of art were stolen. Among the portraits stripped from their frames were works by Vermeer, Degas, and Rembrandt. Estimated at $500 million, the heist has been categorized as the largest and most frustrating of all time. Theories of their whereabouts and those who perpetrated the crime are abundant.
In this podcast series, we will dig as deep as possible into the case, the theories, and the social and economic impact the greatest unsolved art heist of all time had on the community. This is Empty Frames. Welcome back to Empty Frames. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I am doing so well today. I couldn't be better. I'm pumped about this episode. How are you?
Ah, so pumped about this episode, Lance. It's been a while since we've been on these airwaves, in case you aren't following this in real time. But it's been a few months, and a lot has gone down, which we will get into in other episodes. We've got a few left in The Last Dance, Lance, in this season.
Well, we had a couple of really good episodes with Charles Pinning and Pamela Wall. They had worked on an alternative theory about the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist, which involved sort of performance art, which is a really good theory. I still like to consider it as one of the theories, one of the solutions to who actually stole the artwork. But today we have on a very special guest who has worked within Scotland Yard. He's a rock star when it comes to art recovery and art detecting. Charles Hill. Mr. Charles Hill joined us, and he kind of refocused the whole thing for me. I don't know about for you, but he put a bit of a refocus on it for me.
I would say so as well, Lance, and he brings some thoughts and theories and true work that we haven't really had in these airwaves, especially lately. I mean, we've been talking a lot about the recovery effort, and Charlie Hill is someone, as you said, Lance, he's got an incredible history in art crime, in recovering stolen pieces of art. Just Google him. You'll find it out. And we talk about several of the pieces of art that he helps recover. He helped recover during his work. And one of them was The Scream, the famous painting. So he's legit. And what he has to say about the Gardner heist is very compelling.
What really struck me about his theory regarding the Gardner heist was his explicit, repeated concern that he wanted to make sure the people whose names have been associated with the theft do not remain tarnished. He wanted to make sure that their reputations were intact and they could rest assured that their names would no longer be associated with it, including known criminals, including people that we've spoken about in criminal organizations. He says he knows who took the paintings. It's sort of irrelevant at this point, but it's entirely possible to get the paintings back. And again, he repeated, those who have had their names associated with this should rest assured that their reputations will not be tarnished any longer.
And Lance, Charlie Hill was also in the BBC documentary that came out recently. It's called The Billion Dollar Art Hunt. And I loved it. I really enjoyed watching it. Charlie wasn't as keen on it as we are because, you know, granted, he's in it, and it was a much different experience being in something like that and then watching it, because I think it was also recorded a while ago. So I could see his point there. But for us, just Gardner Heist, people who are interested in the subject, very compelling documentary.
Yeah, there were three people on that interview, and two of them liked the documentary, and Charlie Hill was not one of them. Again, for all the reasons that you stated, he didn't like how these pieces of media always goes towards the people whose reputation he's concerned about.
Okay, so let's get to this interview. I think it's really great. I don't want to waste any more time here, Lance. And we talk a good deal about his background in the interview, which I'm sure you're going to find fascinating. So let's throw it to our interview with art investigator Charlie Hill. Charlie Hill, how are you today, Charlie?
Well, I'm keeping a sense of humor. Thanks.
That's good. That's really all one can do in these times is keep a sense of humor and just keep plugging away. Thank you for taking the time to join us on Empty Frames. You are probably one of the most important guests we have had on this show covering the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist. And we're really humbled to have you here. Can you give a little background for the listeners who might not know your exact history, your background, and I guess maybe your qualifications?
Well, I'm approaching my mid-70s, so this could be long and boring, but I'll try and keep it succinct and short. I was born in England, but when I was seven, I went to live in San Antonio, Texas. And as a child, just moved around a lot in the States and Europe, Western Europe. My father was in the, well, when I was born, he was the U.S. Army Air Force, but it became the U.S. Air Force the year I was born. And he was a career officer. And anyway, I was a camp follower along with my sisters and mother. And I went to, high school and then off to university, and I hated it. So I volunteered for the draft in the late 60s, 1967, and was drafted. And spent a year in training and down in the 82nd Airborne down in Fort Bragg in North Carolina. But then I went to Vietnam and was in the Central Highlands for a year. My tour of duty then was in the 173rd Airborne Brigade. And I came back and went back to school to George Washington University. I did very well and won a Fulbright scholarship to Trinity College Dublin, hence my Irish connection. And I married a Dubliner. And so I have a strong family connection anyway to Ireland. And had a couple of years of the GI Bill money coming, and I went to the University of London, to King's College London, and studied theology, thinking I might, well, certainly was considering becoming an Anglican clergyman, Episcopal Church, Church of England kind of guy. And then and when the money ran out, I joined the Metropolitan Police here in London. And I was a police officer for just over 20 years. And I specialized towards the end. I went up through the ranks fairly quickly. I got to what's called Detective Chief Inspector, where I spent 7 years. And then, and during that time, I did a lot of undercover work, right? Overly promoted for that, but I did it and was successful recovering pictures like The Scream in Oslo that had been stolen in 1994 and things like that. And also in 1994, after recovering The Scream, I took my family on vacation to Cape Cod, and I went up to Boston to see Dan Falzone, who's then the special agent with responsibility for the Gardner Museum. I went to see Dan Falzone and told him what I thought, because I'd been involved in some high-profile art recoveries and from major art heists successfully. And I told him what I thought, and I said I suspected there was an Irish connection to this theft for a variety of reasons. I went through them with him, and I mean, you know, he was open-minded, certainly, as in fact have been Anthony Amore, and who's the head of security at the Garden Museum, and Jeff Kelly, who's been dealing with the case for a good 15 years, if not longer. And so I've just pursued my own angle, and Anthony Amore at the Garden Museum has told me that there's nothing to suggest in hard evidence that these things are in Ireland, these masterpieces and the other works of art that were stolen. And I guess I should say, or could say, that I'm not a hard evidence kind of guy. Hard evidence is important, but by and large, my scientific method is to, you know, follow my hunches. That's it. Is that a nutshell enough?
That's great.
Oh, that's a great nutshell.
I know. In reading some background on you, I wondered if you were the most interesting man in the world.
I thought he was going to show up with a Dos Equis.
Yeah, your connection between Europe and America is fascinating to me, and you were in Vietnam, and I read one article where it said you were kind of known with your other your soldiers around you. You were good at dodging bullets, and I think that was when I realized you might be the most interesting man in the world.
I was very lucky, and towards the end of my tour of duty, there were some guys in the squad I was in. Who once mutants, so there was a slight mutiny, and they said they weren't going anywhere without me because they wanted to, you know, they thought my luck was catching or could be catching. I mean, I didn't, when you say dodge bullets, I mean, I didn't run away from anything, but I was extremely lucky, that's for sure.
I think it's very important to identify when you know you're lucky, you know, when you know, like, this is luck, this is a stroke of luck, and I know that it's a lucky situation. I think it's important to identify that. I also think it's important to identify when you have a gut feeling, like you said, you had this, you know, call it a gut feeling that there was a Ireland connection with the stolen paintings. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? Because we've heard a lot about Vermeers really being sought after by, I guess, the IRA, but we're just a couple of podcasters who don't have connections into the scary underworld of criminal syndicates. Where's your gut feeling sort of, where's the genesis of that?
Well, I don't have an answer for that, but one thing I do have very strong feelings about, and it's this. The IRA had nothing whatsoever to do with the theft of those paintings, nor, in fact, did the Italian mafia, the Irish, you know, the Irish Americans in Boston and the Italian Americans in New England were just, as organizations, or, you know, there was no paramilitary sanction from the IRA. There was certainly no organized crime motivation or work at it. To steal those things, it was done entirely by two freelancers. You can call them freelance Comanches if you like. I mean, they just, you know, they went beyond their organizations, and I believe both men were Irish, County Monaghan men, in fact. And I think that the fact that they were essentially on R&R in the New England area at the time meant that. Anytime one talks about, you know, there's an Irish connection to the theft at the Gardner Museum on the night of St. Patrick's Day, 1990, it's a mistake to think it had anything directly or even indirectly to do with the IRA. It was done by two individuals. And I've worked on that ever since I, you know, realized that this was not any kind of organized crime or paramilitary operation, nothing of the sort. Two people, and then tragedy struck in the late 1990s when one of the two, the dominant of the two who went into the museum and stole those things, died. He died in Amsterdam and presumably murdered. And his body's never been recovered, although I have promised the family I'll do what I can to try and recover the body. But ever since this COVID thing broke out, I just haven't managed to get across to the Netherlands. However, when I get back to why I think those paintings were stolen, the paintings and two other objects. One was the finial, the eagle of a regimental banner to one of Napoleon's Imperial Guard regiments. And the other was a Chinese, an ancient Chinese beaker with a name I'm bound to mispronounce. I think it looks like it's spelled Gu and it's pronounced Ku. But anyway, those are two objects in addition to the pictures.
I call it Gu. I heard someone say Gu and I've heard someone say Ku. I just have more fun with the word Gu.
Well, there's a brand of, you know, chocolate dessert in this country here in London called Gu. Certainly isn't that. Anyway, listen, joking aside, the one thing that I'm certain of is that the whole heist, the whole art heist from the night of St. Patrick's Day, 1990, or the early hours of March 18th, has been characterized by both mistakes and tragedy. And the thing is now just to get these things back and to allay the fears of people that their reputations are going to be imperiled somehow by the recovery of these things. They're not. It's a straightforward matter of getting them back to where they belong and getting them, you know, properly conserved and restored, because they're bound to be damaged. I think that's for certain.
So much to address here in that answer. You're fairly certain, probably to 100%, that the two men were from Ireland, and you mentioned the county, but I didn't catch what county it was. What county did you say?
It's a county that borders Northern Ireland. It's called Monaghan. Clint Eastwood regards himself as a County Monaghan man.
Really? He doesn't strike me as a County Monaghan guy. He's more of a Cork guy to me. That was the only other county I could think of off the top of my head.
County Monaghan, is it Carmel where he used to be the mayor? I can't remember.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Sure, that sounds right. But you said one of the men has since died. Was that some sort of a hit? Was that crime related? And you said that was in the Netherlands. And so you're fairly positive that these are the two that went into the museum.
In fact, sadly, they're both dead. One died of overwork, and the other was probably murdered. 1998, and the other brother died in. I'm trying to remember, 2014, I think it was.
Oh, they were brothers?
Yeah.
Wow. And so you were told by someone that it was them, or by one of them?
Yeah, I managed to speak to the brother who died in 2014 before he died. I mean, you know, it wasn't a conversation where he gave a full and frank confession, and it was none of that nonsense. But he did say to me if he'd help me if I helped him locate his brother's body in Holland.
What did he provide to you as evidence that he was one of the two responsible for the actual theft? Did he give you locations or details that weren't published?
Nothing. No, nothing like that. The fact that I was able to contact him meant that he realized that somebody had worked out who had done it. And he was, you know, very gentlemanly about it and you know, as open as a man like that, you'd expect a man like that to be, which was not very open, but, you know, he was polite and seemed interested in my abilities to, as he thought, which I'm still working on, locate where his brother's body is.
I see. So they were in Boston in 1990. What brought them there? Do you know?
I think, without saying too much, I think they were based in Providence, Rhode Island, rather than Boston.
Okay, and they were there for criminal or activity, or was it like a family getaway?
Yeah, it was more family getaway. They're there essentially for rest and recreation.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a bad time in the Troubles in 1990, and periodically people would leave Ireland, and the safest and best place to relax and recharge your batteries was the Boston area.
Gotcha. Wow. Well, you're kind of blowing my mind right now with a missing person plot too. We cover missing people on different shows that we do. So my mind is kind of racing. So I guess where does that bring us to now? Since both brothers are now deceased, what path does the artwork have to be recovered?
Well, that's a good question, because that is what I'm focused entirely on, is the art, recovering the works of art. And, you know, it's still, you know, pay my respects to the brother who I did speak with about this, admittedly only once. You know, I did write to him, and he responded positively and constructively, to my mind. And so I think that it's a tricky problem, but I don't think anybody other than the brother whose plan it was, and who then had these all these pictures and those two other things conveyed to Ireland. I think from what I've put together, I could be wrong, of course, but they were containerized, and they left to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and went in a container to Limerick, County Limerick, and they were taken from there to where they were eventually hidden. So that's what I'm doing at the moment, is working out where they could be. And I think in the past year, since that dreadful TV documentary has been broadcast recently, but since it was made over a year ago, and when I just walked out on it, I just thought it was too childish and stupidly childish of that to have anything more to do with it. In addition to the mendacity and the meretriciousness of the whole damn thing, I think that as far as I've got so far in locating where these things may well be, has progressed significantly. Of course, I don't want those people at, you know, BBC television documentaries to know this. So I'm sure you and your listeners can keep a secret. I'm moving along quite well at the moment. I don't want all that, you know, having stepped in what I regard as a load of crap on my shoe. I'm sort of, you know, that's past. You know, that's a year gone now, and I'm moving, I think, in the right direction.
Well, that's great to hear.
I'm seeing a man tomorrow. You know, to progress it even further. So, you know, this is a day, if not exactly a daily thing, it's frequently.
Is recovering stolen art a little bit of a waiting game with having to wait around for the timing to be right?
Yes, I'd certainly agree with that. It's I think patience is supposedly a virtue, but it's certainly, as far as trying to recover masterpieces in particular, it's something you have to do cautiously and deliberately. And also, in this particular case, you want to make sure that any damage that's been done to them, nothing further is done to damage them. And also, in this particular case, given the nature of some of the people involved in the past and those who had taken interest in it at the present for reputational purposes, you know, they're not people you want to screw around with. And I think that to ensure that nobody gets either maimed or murdered, including myself, you know, is a good idea.
It's an interesting point that you raise, the dangers that come along with it, balanced with the patience, because I guess what's going through my mind right now is how you maintain being patient, not pushing too far, including even doing this interview, because like how far do you put yourself out there so that it's intended, like so that the intention is for certain ears, the right ears to hear it. But you don't want all, you know, you don't want all the information out there. So how do you balance like that? How do you know where to draw the line there? What are the parameters? I'm sure it's case by case, though.
Yeah, I mean, in this particular case, I just, you know, I teeter along, and as long as I don't, you know, fall off the log across the rushing stream below, I should be okay. But I mean, yeah, sure, you know, I got to keep my balance, and I'm not a, you know, high wire, trapeze artist or anything like that. So I take one step at a time deliberately, and I'm also aware that reputationally there are a number of people who do not want their reputation impaired, either their personal reputation or more significantly their national, the Irish nationalism, to be in any way considered to be at fault here, because it's not. I mean, you know, you've got to be straight with people. This has got nothing to do with Irish nationalism. It was a freelance venture that has gone over the last three decades wrong. And I'm competent enough as well as experienced enough to be able to deal with it. I believe a good relationship with Anthony Amore, the head of security at the Garda Museum. And although he thinks I'm wrong, and as he says in his own words, he's in lockstep with the FBI Special Agent Jeff Kelly on this. They think things are in New England, in the Boston area, and I don't. But, you know, they're courteous enough to let me do my thing, which I think is, you know, I think they respect me enough to allow me to, you know, to take my own lead in this. They don't think it's going to go anywhere, but, you know, but as Anthony said to me more than once, certainly once, these things aren't back on the wall yet, so he's willing to listen to me.
That's good to hear that he's open-minded about that. He's obviously doing the right thing by trusting you in your investigation. You were part of Scotland Yard. I mean, that's a pretty good bit to be on your resume if you want to, you know, formally file the application to investigate the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist. It's nice of him to give you the freedom to do that.
Can I interrupt you just for a moment? I'd use the word informally.
Gotcha.
Never been formally told, you know, get on with it and here's a pot of money to do it with. No, it's informal. It's in my own time. I'm in my mid-70s. You know, what else have I got to do that's worth doing? Well, I mean, being a decent human being, I suppose, and trying to be a decent grandfather and husband and father.
Well, you can be all of those plus the guy who gets the Gardner Museum art back on the wall. So that'd be a nice cherry on top, I think.
Oh, we'll see. Yeah. And also, there's another thing I've been involved in over the past 2 decades, and that's the recovery of a painting that was stolen. In fact, a few months after I came back from Vietnam, it was October 1969, and the oratory of San Lorenzo, the oratory of St. Lawrence in Palermo, was hit, and a huge, very fine Caravaggio depiction of the Nativity was stolen. I'm working on that. And also, since it was stolen about 10 years ago, there's a Van Gogh painting stolen in Cairo of yellow flowers and red poppies, and I want to get that back. So, you know, obviously the Gardner Museum pictures are the main ones, but there are other things I'm working on as well.
Yeah, and you've helped to return some real masterpieces. Would you mind giving us a little bit of the story on how you helped to return The Scream?
Well, I was a police officer then. In fact, I was based at Europol when it was stolen in February 1994. I commuted weekends at home, and then during the week I was in The Hague at the Europol headquarters. On that Sunday, I listened to the news before I headed off on the Monday morning, and I puzzled about, well, why would anybody want to steal The Scream? And when I got into my office in The Hague, at Europol headquarters, I had a phone call from a colleague at Scotland Yard, who was the head of the Art and Antique Squad at the time at the Yard. And he said to me, I'm going to call the Norwegian police in Oslo and give them an offer of assistance. You know, can we come up with a plan? So I thought about it for a while. I said, yeah, sure. Tell the Norwegian police that we can get into these people and pretend we're from the Getty Museum in California. And that the Getty Museum, knowing that the Norwegian government couldn't pay any ransom demand if one was to suddenly arrive, certainly the Getty Museum, which at the time and probably still is the wealthiest private institution organization in the art world, and he thought that was a great idea. So anyway, that was the plan, and it worked. I arrived in Oslo, and I was the guy from the Getty, and it worked very well. And we were quite surprised by how relatively little the ransom demand was for the recovery of the painting. But I was quite pleased that when I eventually saw it, in fact, it was brought up from a basement of a summer house in a town called Ashgardstrand, which is south of Oslo on Oslo Fjord. And it was just me and the guy that brought it up from his secret little bunker down there. And he handed it to me. It was wrapped in a blue sheet. So I put it on. Well, it was first week of May in 1994. So everything's all dust covers all over his summer house, over the furniture. So I put it on what was obviously his dining room table. And I took the blue sheet off. And what I hadn't known, I'd done a fair amount of research on the painting, but what I had not known is that Munch had started it on the back. So the first thing I saw was just that central figure of the screen in black. And obviously Munch didn't quite like it. So he turned it over. And in fact, I did exactly the same thing. I turned it over and boom, there it was. And what I'd memorized, because you wouldn't be able to blow out a candle twice the same way, is where Munch had blown out a candle on his original version of the scream. I looked straight for that because I'd memorized how the wax blobs had stuck to the work, and it was exactly as I had memorized it should be. But anyway, whenever you see a masterpiece work of art, no matter how reprehensible the painter may be, and Edvard Munch was seriously reprehensible, but the painting jumps out at you and tells you itself it's a masterpiece. And so I held it and said, yeah, okay. And we went to a hotel. In fact, the hotel's in one of Munch's other paintings, three little girls on a pier looking at the hotel in the distance. And that was the hotel where I put it in. I told him to go forth and multiply with himself, and I'd get hold of my friends in Oslo. And sure enough, the cops turned up, and they were very pleased. And we drove back to Oslo. It was about 50 miles south of Oslo. And that's how I got it back.
What's that like when you know that you're about to recover this? I mean, is your adrenaline just pumping?
Yeah, in that particular case, once I sort of barricaded myself into a room, a day room at that hotel, I went into the minibar and you know, checked out what was to drink. There was no vodka, which broke my heart. And then I tried the wine, and Jesus wept. Was that stuff ghastly? But anyway, I poured myself a drink about 10 in the morning.
Damn. Well, if there's any reason to drink at 10 in the morning, it's when you recover the scream. That's impressive. That's truly impressive. I noticed you got a little figurine of the central character in the scream behind you. Am I seeing this right?
I've got a blow up doll. I think either my son or one of my daughters gave it to me.
I had a question about the route that you were confident that the Gardner paintings went. You said from Halifax, they were in a shipping container, and they went over to Limerick. County Limerick, is that where you believe they currently are, or did they move from there?
No. They moved across Ireland to the Dublin area. No, it's just up the Shannon River there at Limerick, there's a container port.
And then from there, it went down to the Dublin area?
Across to the Dublin area.
And the one brother who you believe was murdered, was he murdered over these paintings?
No, I don't know. I don't know the reason for his death. I mean, I can only speculate, and you know, I don't think that these pictures had anything to do with it.
Okay,
but I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering how it got from their hands in that boat. I guess going from Halifax to Ireland, and then the brothers seem to have both lost the control of the paintings.
No, the brother that organized all of this is, I think, only lost control when he died.
Okay.
Up until that moment, yeah, he was in pretty much full control of that. But he certainly was involved in a variety of things that I suspect led to his death. I don't know what they are, and of course, for me, it's entirely irrelevant. The only thing I'm interested in, frankly, is the safe recovery of these things, without any further damage, and certainly without anybody being injured or murdered themselves. And I suppose one more thing, and I also want to ensure that the wrong people are not blamed, and that would be the Patriarca family and the name of the other family in the Boston area. I think they were both from Providence, Rhode Island, but the Italian mafia, I think, had nothing to do with it, even though, you know, stupidly, people in the Boston mob have claimed an involvement, and people have been running around over the past 30 years assuming that what they say is more or less true. I don't think it's true at all. But on the other hand, it's also, I believe, true that the Irish nationalists, as an organization and as a cause, had nothing to do with this as well. This was entirely two freelance Comanches.
So the one brother that you said had control over it right up until the point where he died, was he dealing them? And the control that he had, is that something that will help you once you understand what he did with them to get them back? Or was he just sort of the gatekeeper for them?
Yeah, not quite the way you pictured it at the moment or depicted it. But he did have, you know, the idea that they would come in useful one day, without doubt. That's why they were taken, one of the reasons why they were taken. also because, you know, like that man that tried to climb up Mount Everest once and died before he got to the top. He said, when he was asked, well, why do you want to climb Mount Everest? He said, because it's there. Well, I think, you know, two guys on R&R in the New England area, knowing about art theft, they decided to try it for themselves, and they did. And it's certainly, I think it's fairly regarded as the biggest art heist, certainly in U.S. history, but also, you know, modern history has been, except for, of course, the Nazis stealing art from the people they murdered, the Jewish families they murdered. This is the biggest art heist of the 20th century.
So where do you begin when you're trying to put forth the best effort to recover these paintings? You knew that they were in the Dublin area. What's your first step? Do you start making phone calls, or do you just sort of observe?
No, I generally write to people. That's what I've done in the past, ever since I left the police. I don't get involved in any undercover work. I mean, that's just crazy. I don't need to. You know, it's counterproductive. Certainly would be for me. So I simply, you know, drop people a line and, you know, explain who I am and say, you know, this is what I've done in the past, and this is what I'm interested in, and if there's any way they could help me, well, here are my contact details. And by and large, you know, people ring me. They say, oh, well, thanks for the letter, I understand, and then we talk. And at first, of course, they're very guarded, and they don't know who I am, and, you know, they may think, you know, I'm doing this on behalf of the FBI or, you know, the local police or something. Well, I'm not, but I do it. And also, I'm not doing it on, well, I am in a way doing it on behalf of the Gardner Museum, but I'm not an employee of the Gardner Museum. I'm just I suppose you'd say, I'm also a freelance Comanche. I'm just doing it because somebody needs to do it, and I'm good at it. And I find this worthwhile doing. And we talk in those terms. In fact, I talk to them exactly like I'm talking to you. You know, muddled stream of consciousness. You know, you think this is a public reading of Samuel Beckett or something, the way I talk sometimes. But
well, you've given me a very calm feeling. You're very, you know, deliberate, kind of stoic in your approach. Very trustworthy immediately, I'd say.
I'm about to confess to the heist.
Gather round, friend, and join me by the fire. I have a secret to share. When I was a child, I lived with my grandma. She allowed me to watch Unsolved Mysteries. Fast forward to 2008, my freshman year of college. A series of armed robberies on campus escalated into a serial rapist's reign of terror. That's when I created my first crime podcast. In January 2014, I picked up the podcast again from my college roommate who fell for an underage girl online, to the chilling story of a murdered nun in 1969 Baltimore, and in the Throwaway series, I share my own journey of overcoming homelessness and how that experience led me to unmask a serial killer and identify three of his Jane Doe victims. This is Foul Play Crime Series, where the stories are real and the truth is waiting to be discovered. Step into the hidden corridors of the past with Hometown History, where every episode uncovers the untold stories and secrets nestled in the streets and alleys of our own backyards. We bring history to life, revealing the extraordinary in the ordinary, from local legends to forgotten tales that shape the communities we know today. Tune into Hometown History and embark on a journey through time, right from where you are.
How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season one that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, but wait, there's more to the story. And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hares from season one, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone. I'm so comfortable. I'm about to tell you what I did with the paintings.
Well, I imagine being likable is something that did come in handy in undercover work, though.
I agree with you. Being engaging is important.
I am curious about the involvement of Martin the Viper Foley. He's been popping up on our radar here and there as we've been covering the Gardner heist, and he recently came into the news in regards to this. You've been communicating with him, correct?
Not recently, but yes, certainly I was in touch with him up until about February this year. But then he had to do a runner. The police told him he was going to be murdered, and people have tried to murder him in the past, so he took a police advice and he disappeared.
And what kind of guy is this? For anyone who's listening who does not know who Martin the Viper Foley, I'm assuming you don't earn the nickname the Viper because you're a soft, cuddly, grandfatherly type.
Well, I'll put my cards on the table about Martin. I like the guy. I'm aware that he's had a criminal record that goes back over 50 years. And I'm aware that he did violently beat up a police officer and member of the Garda Síochána some years ago and destroyed the guy's life, essentially. Didn't kill him, but, you know, he had to leave the police and so forth. But I think that over the years, as he's aged, he's, in my view, and now, you know, I have a small confession to make to you and your listeners. I am what you would call a churchy bastard. And what that means is I'm not overly religious, but I'm religious enough to think that there is some truth in what Jewish, Muslim, and Christian brothers and sisters of mine might think about the meaning of life. And in particular, I think the idea of redemption does, along with his legacy of both his family and general posterity. Martin thinks he's pushing 70. It's time he did something that everyone would admire. And I've encouraged him to think that. I mean, you know, be straight. I mean, I haven't sort of stuck an Are You Safe track on his ass as he stands up and walks around the room. But I do think that there is something to help him think, yeah, there's more to life than what he's done. And if he can help with the Gardner, the recovery of the Gardner Museum things, I'm hoping that he will. I know he's got some problems at the moment, but well, he's always had problems, so I don't know what's new. I think he will help.
What does he know? Does he know where they are currently, or did he know a route in which they took to be where they're at currently?
Well, I mean, he's not some kind of police informant. I wouldn't describe him as an informant. But he and I have talked about things, and he told me he was he did know the guy whose plan it was to break into the Guardian Museum posing as a police officer, and the one who was murdered in Amsterdam. I'm fairly sure he was murdered in Amsterdam. He was a friend of his.
So you can connect us with Martin and get an interview with him, right? We'll give us his phone number or something. No,
he's on the run.
Right.
What a life.
But knowing the kind of guy he is, it's there's a swimming pool nearby and the sun's shining. Unlike in Boston and London at the moment. Worcester, Mass. You're in Worcester, Mass, aren't you?
Our studio's in Worcester, yeah.
So I don't think the sun is shining there at the moment. Unless it could be, I guess. Nice fall day.
Nope, it's snowing.
Yeah, you'd be, yeah. ridiculous.
Yeah, we've gotten about 4 inches of snow.
I live in London. I don't see it much.
Is it mostly rain?
And when it turns to snow, it turns to slush immediately,
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess we're lucky in that it's real pretty out here. It's stuck on the trees still.
Great.
That was one of my favorite parts in the BBC doc, and I know you're not a big fan of it, the Billion Dollar Art Hunt, but when you called Foley with John Wilson, I thought that was really I burst out laughing when he was like, "So he's gone," and you were like, "For fuck's sake, I know he's not answering the phone. You know, what do you want me to do?" That part was great.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I did lose my. I was a little short with poor old John Wilson, but you know, he was asking for it. But the main thing is, I told, obviously, Martin, I didn't lie to him. I was there with Wilson. Wilson wanted to talk to him, and the conversation actually went on for much longer than that damn documentary suggests. And he just, you know, went on and on, banging on about immunity from prosecution and, so on and on. I don't know. I can't see how, given Irish laws as they are, the 2005 Criminal Justice Act and the 2006 Criminal Justice Act, one dealt with terrorist offenses and the other with organized crime. But both of them had sections to deal with benefiting from the proceeds of criminal conduct. And you read those two acts, passed by the Doyle, the Irish Parliament, you'll see that there's no wriggle room there. You know, you're guilty as hell. And this is something that's going to have to be dealt with. That wonderful expression of President Obama's at above my pay grade. I don't know how people will, I just don't know how people are going to work this out. But I have some confidence in Andrew Lelling, who's the U.S. attorney from Massachusetts. And I met a great guy who's a retired director of public prosecutions in Ireland named James Hamilton. I had a good talk to him as well, with John Wilson present, his crew. And I would have thought that the people like James Hamilton, his successor is the director of public prosecutions, and U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling, I'm sure they could work out something. It's so important. I mean, and obviously those laws were passed not in order to prevent the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum masterpieces from being recovered. I mean, it's just the problem with the reward, I think, more than anything else, would be a bone of contention.
And would an itemized reward price list help?
I think Anthony Amore's done an itemized price list, but it all depends on the condition these things are recovered in and all sorts of imponderables at the moment that will have to be pondered in the future. But I'm confident, and you may think I'm just another arrogant son of a bitch who's overly confident, but I do think these things will come back and that these issues will be resolved in a reasonable manner.
What do you think could be done to motivate anyone who knows where one or all of the pieces are to return that? Because let's say someone has the finial, but they don't have, the storm on the Sea of Galilee. What can incentivize them to return that without getting in trouble? Like how would you be able to explain that to this person? Is that even reasonable to consider?
Well, it's certainly reasonable to consider, but I think they're all together. I think everything is together. I mean, I think that ancient Chinese beaker is probably broken, and it'll rattle when somebody picks up the whatever it's wrapped in. The finial will be fine. I mean, that's solid brass. And so far as those pictures are concerned, the masterpieces and the other ones, which are all very valuable, they'll really depend on what kind of condition they're in. And of course, over 3 decades, they're not going to be in museum quality conditions, that's for sure. I just think that things will be able to be worked out. And it's just a matter of doing it cautiously and deliberately and ensuring that no further damage is done, that no one is injured or worse. And finally, that the reputations of people who've been blamed in the past, or people may think should be blamed now, that those reputations are not sullied, because after all, they had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, totally. And I tend to agree with you about them being together, like all together, because they've never been used individually. You've never even heard a rumor of them being used individually to lower a prison sentence or, you know, to barter something. Which brings me to my point that you had mentioned before about one of the gentlemen holding on to them because he knew that there would be a use for them in the future. If they're all together, I guess he never found that use. Is that part of the recovery process, is to get the ear of the person who knows where they're at and say, listen, there's never been a use before for these things. They're almost too hot to handle now. Like, you'd never be able to get away with it now. I mean, everyone's looking for it. Is that like a bargaining tool that you would use?
Well, I think, frankly, it was they were too hot from the moment they were stolen to be used in any credible way. I know people talk about, you know, bartering this, that, and the other for something else, and using things, collateral for a loan, all those sort of things. I've known that to happen in the past, but with these particular works of art, no, it ain't going to happen. It wasn't going to happen, and it was a mistake for someone to even think that they could do this with them or that with them.
So I guess that would be something that might incentivize whoever knows where they're at, because there's no use to keep them. Right,
I think the main draw is probably the reward. You know, because it's a large amount of money. I mean, it's big bucks, 10 million.
Yeah, the problem with that is that it's $10 million if they're returned altogether in good condition, and they'll never be in good condition. Like, just the evidence of how they were removed from the frames suggests that they are not in good condition. So maybe it just needs to be tweaked a little bit. Do you have any thoughts on that? That the recovery process that's implemented by the museum, that after, you know, a decade and a, oh, I'm sorry, after a few decades, they need to figure out a different way to get the paintings back and provide incentives and just tweak the parameters and say, maybe not good condition because we know that's impossible, but maybe recoverable, restorable condition.
Well, people do great things these days with conservation and restoration work, tremendous things. I mean, remember that terrible earthquake in Assisi some years ago, when they really got to work on, you know, Cimabue and the rest of them, Giotto, all their works in the Basilica of Assisi. And I've been there since that work has been done, and it's terrific. And also in Padua, there's a church that was hit by, I can't remember, it was the RAF or the U.S. Army Air Force, or maybe both. In Padua, the Hermitage of St. Jerome, and there's a fantastic painting on the wall by Mantegna. Well, that was just, you know, became rubble. And some brilliant Italian mathematician with his algorithms worked out how to put it all back together again. And it's not all back together again, but it's back together enough. And when you go into the church, quite near the Arena Chapel, the Scrivini Chapel, and it's, you know, amazing. I mean, it's unfortunate that the church happened to be next to the Gestapo headquarters or the Wehrmacht headquarters in Padua at the time when the Allied Air Forces whacked it. But getting back to the paintings, I mean, some tremendous work can be done these days in restoration and conservation.
Absolutely. And I can think of a few companies that are local right in Boston. I wonder if any of these companies would put up some sort of offer saying if these are returned in any condition that we can save them, maybe they can provide that service for free, some restoration firm or even like a 3D printing firm. 3D printing might be able to pull something off with restoring it to some sort of condition that is close to what it originally was. But oh, maybe that's something that we can put a call out for. You know, there are firms that restore paintings and they do a really good job, and maybe they would offer their services to bring it back to something that was almost like it was originally.
Well, ask them. I just don't know. I've got my doubts. That Caravaggio I mentioned to you early on, the nativity scene that was stolen from the Oratory of St. Lawrence in Palermo in October 1969, that has been a copy of 3D, you know, copy has been put back in the oratory, and it looks pretty dreadful to me. It's not as bad as a huge photograph they had of the painting there before that. But no, I think as far as that Caravaggio is concerned, although that'll be in terrible state, it's, you know, 50 years, more than 50 years, since it was stolen, but I'd put my faith in restorers and conservators who, if you could get all the bits together, could actually, you know, rebuild that painting by Caravaggio. Right. I hope. I don't know.
So are there any changes that you would make to the Gardner artwork reward structure?
No, I'd leave all of that entirely to the Gardner Museum trustees.
Yeah.
You know, with advice from Anthony, their head of security, and the input from the FBI and of course, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston.
And the lawyers would be able to figure it out.
I doubt it, but, you know, everybody, including lawyers, could figure it out. I would have thought better than just lawyers alone. I don't have any great faith in lawyers. So.
Okay. It's
a personal thing.
So
I know they charge a lot of money for what they do, but, you know, I'm not suggesting that I think that their work is always brilliant.
Sure. All right.
So your recovery process is starting to shape a little bit more defined in my head right now, because we do focus a lot on what the museum could do as far as adjusting the recovery qualifications for the art to be returned. That's pretty irrelevant in your head, though, correct? Because we're thinking about it in terms of someone knows where they're at. They just need the incentive to return them, and the museum can provide the incentive. But you know where they're at. You just need to work with that person, regardless of what the museum's doing, right?
I think, yes, I think that's the understanding I have with Anthony Amore on behalf of the, you know, Gardner Museum trustees, that I'll just crack on with what I'm doing. And if I'm right, I'm right. If I'm wrong, well, you know, they told me so.
Right. So how big is the area where you think they're at in Southern Ireland?
Oh, I think they're in the Dublin area.
And the Dublin area, Dublin is about the same size as Boston, right?
Slightly smaller.
Slightly smaller than Boston. Okay, so I can picture that, like maybe a Providence, Rhode Island, something like that, slightly smaller than Boston. What do you do? Like, do you have messages out to people to contact you? Or are you just playing? Are you in that like moment where you need that patience?
No, you got me in a slightly difficult position here at the moment, because in fact, I'm doing quite a bit of them with regard to the Gardner Museum pictures right now. But I don't want to tell you what it is. And it's not because, you know, I think you're going to blow me out of the water or, you know, anything like that. It's just that I think it would be imprudent of me to tell you what I'm doing, because I'm, other than to say the reason I'm on this podcast with you, and I'm grateful to you for inviting me along, is to emphasize the fact that both Italian-American organized crime and Irish-American nationalist support for paramilitaries in Ireland, those two groups had nothing to do with this. I mean, all right, there's a tenuous connection between the two guys who actually did the job and you know, as active service unit guys from the IRA. They were there on essentially, you know, a holiday. You know, well, I've called it R&R, and that's more what it was than anything else. But, you know, their organizations had nothing to do with this or what they did. And I think to assuage or to allay the concerns of people, reputational concerns, is the most important thing I can do at the moment with you, if that's all right. In other words, I'm using you, if you forgive me. But I want to try and get that message across.
No, please feel free. We appreciate just talking to you and hearing stories and really being as close as we are right now to the Gardner art. So feel free to use us again if you'd like, if that's what you want to call it. But along those lines, I would love to ask you about the recovery of the Titian rest on the flight to Europe, to Egypt.
Yeah, that was stolen from a big house in the west of England called Longleat, which was owned by Lord Bath and his ancestors. He was quite a character, but he died a year or so ago, and it sounds now that the new Lord Bath. But anyway, he had three pictures on a wall, the Titian and two other 16th century paintings. And they were stolen on Twelfth Night. So that's January the 6th, 1995. 7 years later, I got it back. This is something that the reason I'm also talking to you is I know talking to people on programs like yours works. Because I had spoken about the rest on the flight into Egypt by Titian on a radio program. And I'll be damned if somebody didn't contact the presenter and say, well, I know where it is. And so he said, well, you know, he gave the guy my contact details. I went to see the fellow and I said, all right, you know, maybe we can do something. And I contacted the insurers and the land agent, as he's called, at Longleat, who discussed it with Lord Bath. And they said, get on with it. So I did. And sure enough, this thing appeared in a red, white, and blue nylon sort of plasticky bag at a bus stop outside Richmond Railroad Station, which is where I live in London. And an old guy there with white hair, I was with the fellow I'd been dealing with. I got out of my car and went over to him and I said, well, I'm told by the guy I'm with, this is, you got a picture here that belongs to somebody else. And he just handed it to me, didn't say a word. So I went, got back in my car with the bag and put it between myself and my passenger. And he said, well, aren't you going to look at it? So I pulled outside a Starbucks in Richmond High Street. And I said, okay, you know, the double yellow lines. Anyway, I said, well, I opened up the bag and it was wrapped up in brown paper. So I just kind of tore the paper carefully and I looked, and there was the corner of the painting. And I said, look, that's painted by Titian, and I bet the rest of it was as well. So, you know, I gave it to him to hold. We went back to my office, and both Lord Bath's lawyer and his land agent were there in my office. And we took all the brown paper off, and sure enough, there it was. And so, and they you know, wired to an account he had the reward.
Damn. I get like an adrenaline rush hearing you tell the stories.
I tell you what I did then, and I took the lawyer down to his office in a very smart address in Lincoln's Inn Fields. The lawyer is Farrar and Company. They're the Queen's lawyers. Anyway, so it's all very upmarket. And so, you know, took the picture there and left him and drove home. And then they had a little press conference and, you know, everybody danced around it. And that was that.
So I want to play a hypothetical game before we wrap up. Let's say your episode airs and then 2 days later you get a call, the episode that we're doing right now. And 2 days later you get a call and the person says, I got something to show you. It's in reference to that podcast episode you just did. And they give you an address. What's your next step? Do you call police? Do you call a friend to, you know, maybe be a witness? What's your next step if you were to get a tip?
Well, it would entirely depend on what was said to me. Entirely. So I can't tell you what I would say immediately because I obviously wouldn't know what they would say. But, you know, I've got the idea of what you say. And I would say, right, well, I'd better go and take a look. You want to come with me? You know, or ask somebody to come with me that you know and trust. And I'd, that's how I'd play it. And I'd say, well, I can't come straight away because flying from London to Dublin's a pain in the ass at the moment because it's, you know, you get to Dublin, you got to tell them where you're going to stay for the next 14 days and all of that, the COVID stuff. And I know that the current lockdown in Dublin should end on December the 2nd. So it's just a month's time. And I'll come over right after that. So, you know, I suppose you could say that's playing it long. I think it would be foolhardy, downright foolish, to inform the Irish police, the Dublin police. Although I think, because I've got a good rapport with Anthony Amore, I'd let Anthony know, you know, what pretty much has been said to me and what my plan is. I mean, after all, he might like to think, oh, that's great, that's what we've been waiting for. He might like to fly over to Dublin himself. Mind you, he'd have the same problems between now and December the 2nd that I'd have, which is, you know, what do you tell Irish authorities you're going to stay in one hotel for the next 2 weeks and for lockdown? You know, so all the crap that's going on at the moment, you know, you've got to factor that in as well.
Right, right. And I'm assuming that your next call pretty quickly after Anthony Amore would be to us, right? That would be, if that wasn't your first call.
I would certainly ring you to thank you. That's for sure.
I would be on a plane so fast.
Well, Charlie, yeah, this has been really great getting to spend some time with you and to talk about stolen art recovery and the Gardner art with you. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we wrap up?
Well, Tim and Lance, I just appreciate your time and my opportunity to speak. I know that I tend to ramble, but I think I've said everything I want to say. And my main concern and my main interest in being on your program was to try and allay the suspicions people have that their reputations are going to be impaired. No, this is just something that needs to be done now and can be done, and the wrong people do not need to be blamed for it.
Thank you for listening to this fantastic show on the Crawlspace Media Network.
We want to talk to you about another show on the Crawlspace Media Network.
If you like true crime, we've got something a little bit different for you with Empty Frames. We cover art crime, and mostly an art heist that happened in Boston, Massachusetts in 1990.
Not any heist, Tim. We're talking about the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist that happened on March 18th, 1990, and it is considered to be the most successful and valuable heist in history.
That's right. Those nasty thieves stole works from Vermeer, Degas, and Rembrandt, and there is currently a $10 million reward for the return of the stolen artwork.
Not a single piece of evidence has ever been retrieved from this heist, so dive into this mystery with us in Season 1. And in Season 2, we tackle other art crimes and other moments in art culture. We chat with the owners of an antique store who found that famous stolen de Kooning painting. We discuss a stolen Da Vinci with our good friend Turbo Paul Hendry.
And in Season 3, we dive back into the Gardner heist.
That's right. We open the doors back up to the Gardner heist in Season 3, and we even introduce a brand new theory that is very far removed from the current local mobsters and organized crime theory.
So subscribe on Stitcher Premium, on Spotify, YouTube, or Apple Podcasts to listen to Empty Frames, an art crime experience.